All right, welcome back. 239-1310. 239-1310's Afternoon News name is everybody has heard about the Indiana State Teachers Association. Their name is what they are. They represent a large number of teachers all across the state of Indiana in large school districts and small. Teresa Meredith is the president of the Indiana State Teachers Association, and she joins me live. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Was I correct that ISTA represents not just teachers in big city school systems, but in the suburban areas and maybe even the rural areas?
You're correct. We have locals that range from just a few members way out in the cornfields all the way to large urbans like Indianapolis and Evansville and Fort Wayne. We also represent some bus drivers, secretaries, school nurses, some of that realm of employment as well.
Under the restrictions that the legislature and the previous governor have put on teachers now, what is ISTA limited to doing on behalf of teachers?
Well, we still can bargain wages and wage-related benefits. Mm-hmm. We do that. We train our locals to work with their local school corporations for those negotiations. There are numerous other things we can discuss with administration, but at the end of the day, those things then are still up to the administration. But we hope that they enter in good faith in conversation with us to discuss challenges that we may be facing with the perhaps needs in the classroom, that sort of thing.
From the perspective of teachers, what are the biggest issues Hoosier teachers face today?
Discipline is huge. Teacher evaluation is a big issue. And then all of the testing, trying to figure out how to do the instruction that we believe our students truly need, while at the same time meeting all of the demands of multiple levels of assessing or testing.
We had the privilege of talking with two IPS teachers who were honored as part of the run-up to the Hubbard Awards this year. And in talking to them, they talked about one of the things that they would like if they could wave a magic wand was getting rid of what they felt was the rigidity in teaching. They made it seem like it was almost like an assembly line that you got to do this day, that it's just very rigid. And it just kind of took me by surprise because that's not what you would expect of a teacher. Is that rigidity real?
It is very real, and that is very real, whether it's rural, urban, suburban. It doesn't matter where you go. You'll hear teachers talk about that rigidity. And you know, Amos, it wasn't true 20-plus years ago when I started teaching.
So given that we've had the worst winter in 20 years, and we didn't – this is the winter since all this rigidity and standards,
right.
How have the snow days – on the two-hour delays affected what classroom teachers are going to have to do?
Well, you know, do you remember the days when we would take home that little folder that we decorated with all of the pages in it for our snow day work, and we'd come back to school, and maybe we did them, maybe we didn't. Those days are gone. In terms of delay days, particularly in the elementary schools and perhaps in middle schools, but I hear mostly from elementary on this, that their day is juggled. Because they have to get to the core subjects that they think their students are going to be tested on, the kind of content they still need to get to.
So they're teaching, they really is teaching to the test.
It is. Now, if the test is built around the standards, you could argue then that you're teaching the content and the standards in the right way, that the test is merely an assessment of how well students have retained that information. But at this point in the game, we're so close to testing that, yes, you're looking at what needs to be taught most aggressively and then letting other things fall until you get that done until test day.
Given the severity of this winter, now the winters may be mild for the next 10 years, but should the state and should school districts start looking at emergency measures if you start running into January and February with bad winters and here comes ISTEP in 2 weeks? Goodness.
Well, I think if we move to this growth model where we're testing at the beginning of the year and then we're testing if we're doing that, Amos, mm-hmm. then there's some flexibility in that. Okay, you're testing the first couple of weeks of school and then you're not testing till the end of the year.
Right.
But when you set a date, you're saying that in this date in March, you're going to test, and you don't care how many snowstorms there are. You don't care if you started school on July 30th or August 30th. You will take this test on March whatever, and everybody will take it on that date. So some students will have more or less time depending on what snow region they're in or when they started school.
Right.
So a beginning of the year and an end of the year kind of assessment that measures, truly measures student growth, really fits.
We're talking with Teresa Meredith. She's the president of the Indiana State Teachers Association. That is the labor organization representing most unionized teachers in Indiana. Is that fair to say?
That is very fair to say, yes.
Including teachers in IPS. What other districts in the Indianapolis area does ISTA represent?
Almost every township school, IPS, and then the surrounding counties as well. And then pretty much statewide, there are a few pockets, for example, in the Gary area. We're not there, but we're pretty much everywhere else.
Whenever there's talk about teachers union in Indianapolis, it's always focused on IPS. What other issues exist for your members in the townships?
You know, you're hearing the same kinds of issues in terms of the discipline, the evaluation, the testing, those issues. Really wanting to be able to truly teach to the student and find his or her interest and really expand on that is a piece that we all would love to go back to doing, and being allowed some flexibility, allowing the standards to drive our instruction, but not to the point of being so scripted. So that's a pretty common issue around the state.
You're talking discipline. The previous guests that were here from Concerned Clergy have concerns that schools are pushing kids out, not for committing hard crimes in school, not for assaulting teachers, assaulting your members, but for what they would consider minor instances. When I hear a teacher or your organization talk about discipline, break that down.
Sure.
I want to make sure the audience understands your perspective.
Well, let me give you an example. 20-plus years ago, if I was bitten by a student, my background is mostly kindergarten. I've taught some middle school, but mostly kindergarten. So if I was bitten by a student or spat on by a student, I'd contact my principal. I might call the parents after school, but it would be an issue that I had support, either from the staff, the administration, or from the parent.
Right.
Today, something like that happens, and I look for support. I try and figure out who I can go and help me help this child. But at the same time, it's disrupting class because I've got so much I have to teach in such a little bit of time, and I can't turn that over to an assistant or to a student teacher. I have to make sure that I get that content knowledge taught. And so the student who is creating kind of a continual maybe disruption, unfortunately, sometimes gets pushed either to a principal's office, or we're trying to find a way to get them moved aside so we can get to the rest of the class. So, now, I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that there is this tension between how we manage our classes and how we get all the content taught that we're expected to teach.
So it's sort of like it is assembly line, in that if you're, from what I've heard from people who worked in an assembly line, if something goes wrong in the line, or maybe the assembly is not on a particular vehicle, is not working right, you push that car off the line. What that's causing the problems to keep the line moving.
That's correct. You know, there was a time when if I sensed, even when I was teaching fourth, fifth, and sixth grades, that if I sensed that my students weren't focused or engaged and we needed to go outside and run around the playground or just take 10 minutes to catch our breath, get outside and get some fresh air, we could do that. But today's academic schedule is so rigorous for so many school systems that even that flexibility is gone.
Do parents and grandparents realize that?
I don't know if they realize it or if they just assume that, well, we only have this much recess time and it's a lot less than we used to have, or lunch has been cut to 20 or 25 minutes instead of 30. They're not allowed to talk at lunch. I don't know if they see those things as, well, they're just trying to manage our students.
How can you have lunch and not talk?
Hey, Amos, in some of our schools, that's a challenge that unfortunately some of our schools think that's a good idea.
Is that for discipline reasons?
For discipline, trying to get kids to hurry up and eat in the very short amount of time they have before they have to get back to the academics, or before they run outside for their super short 10-minute recess. It just we've really, really come to a different place than we were 22 years ago. Now, we needed to make some changes, But wow, have we really assembly lined, as you
I can't
your
eat
term.
Lunch at my desk in 20 minutes. I probably could, but then I got distractions or people are coming in.
Amos, teachers can't eat lunch in about 3 minutes flat and grade papers and go to the bathroom and deal with a recess at you all at the same time.
There are people listening that think the only place you can eat lunch and not talk is in jail.
No.
It's crazy. See the things you learn when you talk to a teacher. 239-1310. 239-1310 this afternoon's name is. Let me start with Raymond with Teresa Meredith of ISTA. Hi, Raymond.
Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have a question. I came out of school in the 80s, and I'm wondering, how do you determine now what the students learn since you have such a stringent criteria to follow? Like, as when I was growing up, we were taught more hands and feet items versus computer and technology, and how much time is spent balancing that, because, or how much input do the teachers have what is being taught? Because if they're giving the standardized testing and so forth, who determines and how often is it determined when the criteria changes?
Great question, Raymond.
Raymond, thanks. That is a good question. First, let me qualify some of the responses I've given by saying, you know, most of my experience is elementary and middle school, so okay. I'll try and speak in broader terms moving forward here on the show. But the question that Raymond has is a good one. In terms of input, it often varies by the corporation in terms of the local input that is allowed. There should be some good discussion and inclusion of educators from the very beginning on decisions like how much academic time should be spent on different subjects and how rigid the curriculum should or shouldn't be internally. But the standards themselves are determined at a state level, and sometimes there's national impact to that as well. So when the state produces standards like it's preparing to do now, those standards then go back to the corporations, and the corporations have to wrestle with how do we make sure all of our students get to a place where they can master and demonstrate some of this.
And a standard would be if a kid's in the fourth grade, they should know how to do X.
They should know and be able to do whatever the standard is, and maybe it's some sort of a computation or an algebraic skill or a language arts skill or a spelling skill or whatever the content area. So even in your high school courses, there are some like end of course assessments that teachers build their curriculums around.
239-1310. 239-1310. Let me go to Diana. Hi there.
Hi, Amos. I just have a comment about what your guest had just said about the children had to eat in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I work in the cafeteria serving breakfast and lunch, and Amos, it is ridiculous how fast these kids have to eat. Now, I work at elementary, and it is so hard for the little young kindergartens, first graders, to sit down and eat because, you know, they're all eager. They're seeing their friends. They're out of the classroom for a minute. But to me, that's just not right that you have to force these kids to eat real fast. And then the teachers, they as well don't have much time. They have to eat and walk around the cafeteria while they're watching the kids.
I am learning something today because I thought lunch – now, granted, I'm an adult, so, you know, I work in a job where I get an hour, a theoretical hour lunch hour. I know there's people that work on jobs. Their lunch hour might be 30 to 45 minutes. 20 minutes for a kid. I had never heard of such a thing.
Well, you know,
is this just Indiana, or is this occurring across the country?
You know, I think it depends on the pocket of the country that you look at, but particularly here, there are some schools who do still call it a 30-minute lunch for kids.
Right.
Part of that time is cleaning up and lining up. But when you really look at the time, for example, she mentioned kindergarten and first grade, you know, the first few weeks of school are torture for kindergartners trying to figure out how to open, you know, lunch cartons and things. And right. So it does take a lot more of the teacher's time and the assistants, whoever's in there helping. It takes all hands on deck to get them ready. So, yeah, it's a real challenge. It's a real challenge. And then you have to decide, okay, do I take away from the instructional time? How do I balance everything? And that is a real challenge in today's educational world.
239-1310. 239-1310 this afternoon's name is. We'll take a break. When we come back, ISTA has concerns about this piece of legislation in IPS. It's called 1321. That the school system didn't design it. So some Republicans designed it and put a piece in there that got everybody all upset, at least on the right, on the progressive side of the issue, when they were using this bill to beat up on teachers. For no good reason.
It's Afternoons with Amos after these.
We were talking during the break with Teresa Meredith, head of the Indiana State Teachers Association, and I was telling her that I've got listeners on this program that want manners and behavior taught in schools, and you're telling me it's not in the standards, and if it ain't in the standards, we ain't teaching it.
Unless we can figure out how to work it in that language arts or math lesson pretty easily and quickly, no. No, you know, we used to teach social skills, how to get along, how to share, how to wait your turn. Mm-hmm. Those are things that we really struggle to find a way to teach now in kindergarten and first grades.
239-1310. All right, so this Bill 1321 that began in the House, sponsored by Representative Boehning from Marion County and a couple of suburban counties are in his district. Nobody knows exactly where this bill came from. It didn't originate at IPS, but it would create something called innovation schools using underutilized parts of IPS buildings. The original bill had something that said any teacher that worked in these innovation schools would be non-unionized by state law. Democrats scream bloody murder, and I think the Republicans realized, we got caught. That was taken out, as I understand it, but you guys still have serious concerns. What's the concerns?
Our concern initially was that the education and the education leadership within IPS, the Indianapolis Education Association, was not consulted at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And many times if you really want something to take off the ground, you need to work with the educators from the very beginning to at least inform them and bring them along.
So when Boehning drafted this, and his district does not include anything in IPS, he didn't talk to anybody in IPS, not even classroom teachers?
No, not to my knowledge. He didn't. He didn't call ISTA either. I don't believe he called IEA. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, when it first started coming out and we were hearing about all these things that Superintendent Farabee was doing to get community input, and then we heard about this bill, we began asking our leaders there, hey, what's going on? And they were as puzzled as we were. Now, since then, I will say to Superintendent Farabee's credit, he is talking with and meeting with Ann Wilkins and Rondell and Cornett and other education leaders within IEA. I don't know where those talks stand today, but we still have some serious concerns about the bill.
Have you had a conversation with Superintendent Farabee?
I have not yet. No, I've not had the opportunity to meet him yet.
One of the questions that I had is IPS had located a charter school, KIPP, in an IPS building several years ago at Coleman Middle School, and currently there is a charter school in Lasse that is currently housed in the same building as Gambold. And those existed, and as I understand it, and I don't know whether IEA, which is your affiliate for the teachers in IPS, whether they objected to that, and Dr. White just went along and did that. But it seems to me there was a precedent set where at least there was a separate school located within an IPS building.
Well, I think Dr. White would at least reach out to IEA and talk with them from the beginning. There are parts of discussion that administration can actually go forward with as long as they've demonstrated good faith discussion with the education leaders in their corporation. And many times Dr. White did that. He did what he and the board felt were the right things to do in their minds. But he did bring along and include in the conversation, whether they agreed or not, he did bring along IEA at times. So hopefully Superintendent Farabee will begin to do that more readily than he's demonstrated so far.
Is there also, given that IPS has much more capacity than they will ever have students in the short term or over the next decade, that if this is something that allows a building to stay open, allows an existing IPS school to remain intact, and somebody just comes in and allows, and utilizes other parts of the building, and I understand the law has been amended to allow that other school to allow teachers to organize and then bargain for wages and conditions. Isn't that something better? Isn't that preferable to closing a school? If you close a school, then then there's the job situation.
Well, there's the job situation, but there's also the challenge for the community around that school building, because we know that school buildings really are the hub of many small communities within a larger community. Mm-hmm. I think the bigger question, though, really for IPS is so multifaceted. They need to look at, as the report indicated that came out this week, I applaud IPS, by the way, for seeking some outside feedback on what kinds of things they ought to be doing.
Was IEA involved on that task force?
I don't believe so. I believe the report came up, but I do applaud some of the information that came back to be considered. And so hopefully with the report, IEA and the leadership, and then Dr. Farabee and the board, or whoever's on the discussion team with the administration, can talk about some of the things in that report. You know, one of the things they said was look at the difference in enrollment then versus now and how many buildings we aren't utilizing. And maybe we should be consulting with a real estate, you know, a realtor, who does this sort of thing to determine if some of these should be sold. Now, I'm not advocating that you close a whole bunch of buildings. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it doesn't make sense to have buildings sitting empty. Now, if you let a charter school rent buy it, it's a buck.
Yeah.
So that doesn't help IPS. So they need to look at alternatives. So I would say, hey, what about community services? Are there community services that could go into those buildings instead of charters? Because the one of the most successful charters in Indiana is down in Evansville. And it was one of the original ones that was chartered. It's part of the school system. It's called Signature Academy. I don't know if you're familiar with that. And the corporation has treated it as what I thought charters were originally designed to be, part of the school system. The teachers have bargaining rights. The students receive services and supports from the corporation, but yet the teachers have a little more freedom to be a little more creative and innovative.
And I think people originally, I think people up here were under the impression that IPS was the only school district that had the authority under the original charter law to charter. It's now, actually went back and reread the legislation, it is any school corporation in the state. And so Evansville chartered, and the teachers that are in that charter, which is part of Evansville, are union teachers.
Absolutely.
But have the flexibility that teachers are supposed to have in a charter.
Yes, that is correct.
So would IEA and ISTA's position be if IPS elected to do a charter and allow those teachers to be IEA, ISTA teachers and have, you know, charter flexibility and still be union members, y'all would be down with that?
Perhaps, but not selling it off. Not selling it off. See, the difference is Evansville.
Yeah, that's
hosts
a part of the Evansville school, which
is
similar.
Absolutely.
Similar to Boston, has charter schools that are part of the Boston public schools. The same with New York City. The same with Chicago. There are a lot of other.
And but not selling it off to the highest bidder per student. So
no, I've heard that the teachers in those charters in those school systems are union teachers. They may be in a different bargaining unit, but they are either AFT teachers or
ISTA or NEA
yes. teachers.
That is correct, I believe. Mm-hmm. Like the ones in Evansville, they are part of the local association and ISTA and NEA as well.
See the things we learn on this program. Let me go to Bobby at 239-1310. Hi there.
Yes, Amos.
Yes.
Okay, I'm a child of the 60s, okay, and I went to Shortridge High School, where we were college prep school. Okay, back then we had industrial arts, which you learned electricity and mechanical drawing. What happened to those courses, and why can't they start them up again in the schools?
Well, now now you done opened up another can of worms. Where is ISTA on? Because some of the things Mike Pence has talked about in education is definitely not what Tony Bennett and Mitch Daniels talked about. And the governor has talked a lot about vocational.
Well, you know, Bobby, we moved towards this emphasis for a period of time where all we seemed to be talking about was college prep, college prep, college prep, college prep. Decorate your schools, get your kids interested, take them to visit colleges. Some of our young people have such skill in so many other things that don't necessarily require the traditional 4-year go away and live at a college, get a piece of paper and do something with that sort of thing. What you're talking about is what we call now career and technical schools, and there's definitely this wave to move back to that. Educators have been screaming for that, seeing a real need there, and the governor and Superintendent Ritz both have acknowledged that they really want to make opportunities available to students, not just a college track coursework.
But how does vocational fit into standards?
Well, we have to.
Is that the tricky part?
It sort of is. But, you know, the K-8 path is the core set of standards. Once you get that foundation, then what do you do with it? Which way do you head? What kind of diploma? There's so many different kinds of high school. You know, when I graduated from high school, you got a diploma.
Mm-hmm.
And now there are multiple kinds of high school diplomas. There's the Core 40 and the honors and the technical honors. And so I think within those, there are ways for career and technical programs to be utilized. But in terms of their growth or grant monies, that sort of thing to keep them going, they do depend a lot on federal and state grant monies. So I don't know the current status of whether they're growing in Indiana or not.
On a couple of occasions, Governor Pence has said this. He said this in the chair that you're sitting in, Teresa Meredith, where teachers ought to have more freedom to teach. I'm sure you've heard the governor say that. Are you waiting to see the action behind his words?
I'm anxious to see what he defines that as. What does he mean when he says freedom to teach? I got a tiny little glimpse of that perhaps at the roundtable meeting last week. He did talk about the need for and acknowledge that some schools are doing a good job of trying to give students experiences in middle school with regard to different careers and opportunities, perhaps with different fields of work. So I'm not sure yet what he means by this freedom to teach, but he was talking more about the career piece. And I would really like to, even in the early
and
grades,
you've not had a conversation,
have more flexibility.
You've not had a conversation with him?
No, not directly with Governor Pence yet.
With all this staff he's got, the CECI, this agency that so we'll be dealing with education and careers and what have you?
Well, you know, we have a State Department of Education, and then there's that, isn't there like a career council, and there are just so many different layers, and I don't understand why we now have CECI, the CECI, who now is supposedly trying to coordinate things. It seems like that's a waste of money, another layer of bureaucracy. And, you know, taxpayer dollars ought to be spent a little more wisely than that.
Let me go to Greg at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hey, Amos, how are you?
Fine.
And hello to your guest.
Hello.
I just wanted to make a comment about what's going on in IPS. I taught with IPS for 29 years. I retired a couple years ago. And the reason I retired was because of the level of disrespect that teachers are having to deal with, and also the workload. And perhaps your guest can talk about this. The workload that teachers have to deal with nowadays is ridiculous. My sister teaches third grade. She's also with IPS. And all she does on the weekends is schoolwork. I mean, I go over to visit her, and she just got work spread out all over the floor, and that's what she does all weekend. They've taken away the preps. I remember my last year teaching, I was tutoring during my prep period. So you have no prep. You really don't have any time to do anything. And a lot of teachers go in at 6:30 just to keep and stay till 7 or 8 just to keep up. I think it's ridiculous. The evaluation process is totally unfair. You've got principals who play favorites. They've targeted older teachers, try to get them out. You're talking about discipline. You know, they're building all these prisons. They've got to have some clients put in there. They're trying to get records on these kids at a young age. And I think it's ridiculous. Anybody, you don't have to be an education expert to know that a tired, exhausted teacher is not a good teacher. It's not an effective teacher. Cursive is not required anymore. What is that all about? What are these people doing to public education? I think it's totally reprehensible. And I don't think these parents know what's going on, and they need to find out. They need to stand up for their kids, because it's the kids that are suffering, okay? The kids are suffering. You can't mix politics and education. That should never be the case. And you also, when you try to make schools into money-making entities, the kids are going to suffer. I think it's terrible. I know that the union, when I taught, we had a strong union. Rhonda Lynn Cornett was our building rep. She did an outstanding job. But they watered down the union. And now teachers are just having to hang on to their jobs. Professional development every week makes no sense. None at all. And I just wanted to voice my opinion on that because I made my living with IPS. I love IPS. And there are a lot of great teachers, and those kids need all the help they can get. And these politicians and businessmen are steady trying to destroy that school system. And they're well on their way. I predict in another 5 years there won't be an IPS. That's my comment, and I appreciate you taking my call. Thank you.
All right. I appreciate that, Teresa Meredith.
Wow, there was so much in what he said, and at one point I found myself actually tearing up. I hear the anguish in his voice, and I hear that frequently, you know, from elementary to high school. There was a German teacher on Sunday who I saw something that he's a friend of mine who posted on Facebook about just finishing after, I think, 700 and some papers that he graded. And it is overwhelming sometimes, the workload. And it's not just the grading papers anymore. The grading papers, that's part of the job. You make an assignment. You need to grade it and get your feedback back to your students. But there's so much more now. We're having to look at our curriculum, redesign curriculum, rewrite curriculum, look at assessments, do assessments between assessments. And then there's all the discipline logs and the individualized instruction.
Wait, what's a discipline log?
Well, if you've got a student with a behavior problem, you need to come up with some sort of a discipline or a behavior plan. And maybe it's an agreement between you and the parent, or between you and the corporation and the parent. And it's all in an attempt to keep the student in the least restrictive environment or in a classroom so they can get some academic support, while at the same time trying to manage the rest of your class, while at the same time preparing for the evaluation. So when your evaluation time rolls around, if you've got a behavior problem in your class that you're not able to manage while you're being observed and trying to teach the rest of the class, so you think, okay, I can't send him out, because if I send him out, then I'll get written up for sending a student out for some additional assistance or support. So I keep him, and then I get written up because I've kept him, and they're distracting the other students. And so it's just this vicious, vicious circle in the discipline piece that he's talking about. But the workload really is phenomenal. Our class sizes are much larger than they used to be, which brings with it more work. Now, that's not true statewide. Some school systems are still managing somehow to keep class sizes manageable, but it, particularly in elementaries, I'm hearing of those class sizes growing.
Is the technology adding to the workload? The fact that in a lot of schools grades are electronic, so students are looking at their grades every day or every other day. If the parents are into it, they're looking at it every day, every other day, which puts pressure on the teacher to grade the papers, to download the grades, so the student can the parent can react to it.
Well, it used to be.
Okay.
When teachers weren't as comfortable with technology, that used to be the challenge, or they didn't have access. Some still don't have access at home. But more than likely, many of the folks that talk about the workload include things like putting the IEPs, or the individualized education plans for special education students, have to be done online. They have to all be inputted. And you're talking many, many pages of documentation. So it takes more than just a couple of hours to fill all of that out per student. So if you've got a caseload of, 50, 60, 100 students, you've got all those documents to enter in preparation for case conferences that you don't necessarily get school time to do that. If you are entering, some schools require lesson plans or daily blogs or posts about what's going on in the classroom, homework hotlines that are posted online, all that technology that can't be done during instructional time. So it has to be done some other time, and it sometimes gets done right after school, sometimes late at night.
And schools are not hiring interns or assistants that can help with that.
No. Some of that is, information that cannot be released to privacy laws, things like that, and that would be part of it. Another part would be money. Even if they could, even if it was just pure clerical stuff, does the school even have the money to hire that person to help support?
239-1310 is afternoon's name. Let me go back to the phones. And Lisa, hi there.
Hey, Amos. I just have a quick comment.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's being pipelined through the schools as far as getting jobs, and this country has moved into a volunteerism. So if people want jobs, they need to either go to school or volunteer. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere, and start doing something. But everything is in a systematic, done in a systematic way. And, I mean, it's kind of crazy. It's madness here in Indiana, but, I mean, that's just the way it is.
All right, appreciate it.
I just thought I'd give you that.
I appreciate it. Let me go to Anonymous at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hello, Anonymous.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
I just want to make a comment. I think this is my opinion. The school system with the teachers, I think that before anybody go and try to revamp the system, they need to actually come into the school themselves, not announcing I'm coming into the school, but actually go into the school. Maybe they need to substitute. They need to actually be in a classroom, see what's going on in the schools firsthand before you go and try to change the policy or make policies or do something that would really help the students. The students are suffering. They come into middle school without knowing how to read. That's a problem in our elementary school. Elementary teachers should have caught them and should have given them special treatment, special help. Something needs to be in place to teach these students how to read so that when they come into middle school, they're not clowning and acting crazy because they can't read. They're very disrespectful. We had to take tests about bullying. Kids bully the teachers. They curse teachers out. They have no respect for teachers at all. They say anything they want to say. They talk about sex. They talk about violence. They say anything they want to say in front of adults, and they don't do their work. These kids in ITS, they need help, and we're not helping them in the way that we should help them. It's not rocket science. It can be fixed, but nobody is really looking at the situation hands-on. They actually need to come into the classroom instead of sitting back talking about theories that don't work with these particular students. You need to get in the room. You need to get in there as a teacher yourself. You don't have to teach. You can come in as a substitute. Just work in there for yourself, and you can see what's going on so that you can really actually know what you need to do to make it right. It's not rocket science, and it can be helped.
All right, good point. I would have loved to have paid to see Mitch Daniels teaching a class. Of course, he's the president of the university. How come he... Is he teaching a class? There are other university presidents that go and teach a class. He's an ex-governor. That would give him – he doesn't need a license to teach. He's at a university. He'd just be an adjunct professor of something or other. We'll be back with our Many Moments with Teresa Meredith. When we come back, I want to ask her, from Ista's point of view, does she have a solution of parental involvement? We'll be back with more after these. Ista got a solution or an idea to improve parental involvement?
Well, let me dig around in my bag and find that crystal ball, Amos.
That's another challenge.
It sure is. And it's in every community. But when you look at urban communities, I think it's particularly a challenge to get parents truly engaged. And you have to be very creative and think outside the traditional ways of engaging parent involvement. I actually did some research on parent involvement and what it took in different kinds of scenarios. And I think when you really look at a parent and you realize that they're sending you the best thing they have, it's the absolute best thing they have. It might be a 16-year-old crazy kid. It might be a first grader who spits and bites and screams. And it might be an absolutely well-behaved, well-rounded, ready-to-go kind of kid. But a parent is sending you the best they've got. And if you start with that premise and you try and assume that the parent is not angry at you if they seem upset about something, and you try and find a way to connect with them on a positive level, that changes things a little bit. Sometimes that means some really unconventional things, though, going to the places where parents are. And sometimes that's really uncomfortable. Sometimes it's not such a big deal. Sometimes you have to go to their places of employment or their apartment complexes or wherever it is to get them if they're not engaging through traditional means like parent-teacher conferences and phone calls. You know, in this world today, we've got texting, we've got cell phones, we've got, all the social media, that kind of thing. There's so many different ways now to connect parents, and it doesn't necessarily mean they have to be coming into a classroom.
From ISTA's perspective, if a teacher is not doing their job, why shouldn't they be told goodbye?
If an administrator's doing their job, that teacher won't continue to be in a classroom. We don't believe that the colleagues down – we don't want the colleagues down the halls from us to be not performing well because when one isn't performing well, it reflects negatively on all of us. And so we would say to make sure – that our role is to make sure that teacher is treated fairly and that they're given the opportunity to improve unless it's something that needs – that's an immediate dismissal sort of thing. And if they can't get it together in the plan of action time that's been created – if they can't follow that plan and get it together in the time allotted, then they need to be moved on. And that's hard for an administrator sometimes to do that. But that an administrator needs to do their jobs. Administrators need to do their jobs.
Is that something people misconstrue about ISTA and teachers' unions? That, hey, we're don't get rid of them at all. Let them stay forever till it's time for them to retire.
I think so. I think they assume that. What we really do is advocate to make sure their rights, whatever rights are afforded to them by law, have been honored.
The due process,
the due process, exactly, whatever rights they have in their contract. But if they shouldn't be in a classroom, we don't want them there. And so we will counsel them too and say, hey, you know what? It is best that you retire early. Mm-hmm. Or, you know what? This really isn't the profession for you. The track record's here. Your administrator's got everything they need to fire you. So we suggest you resign and go find some other job mm-hmm. outside of education. Now, that doesn't happen a lot, right. But that is part of what we do.
Let me go to Anonymous right quick at 239-1310. Anonymous, you got about a minute.
Hello, Amos. My opinion is she was talking about a discipline list.
Mm-hmm.
We're building all these new prisons and everything. We already have the old prisons filled. So these discipline lists, they're just a list for these kids that are in trouble and that stay in trouble. They're going to go so far, and then they're just going to check them off and write them off and say, okay, we got a new prison for you. That's where you're going.
Sad but true. I heard a statistic, and I can't recall the source. I apologize, Amos. Maybe you know that at one time the Indiana prisons, the number of beds needed was built around ISTEP.
I've heard that third grade. I don't know whether that's an urban legend.
It may be an urban legend, but it's been around a long time. Yeah.
Let me go to one more anonymous at 239-1310. You got about a minute.
Hi. I just wanted to state that I also understand about that from grade school to prison pipeline. But also that we have to realize, too, that when they lower taxes, especially in Indiana, there's other states that has done that, they also was targeting the urban areas. They wanted to get rid of public schools. They have been trying to do that for like years and years and years, and they're still trying to get rid of them. But what I wanted to say to the teachers union, that you all going to have to, get yourself together and be stronger. They have tried to gut, and they've been trying. At the same time, they're doing the getting rid of the public schools. They've been trying to get rid of the teachers union, and it's deplorable. And that's what I wanted to say. It's
right.
Plain deplorable.
Good point. And these ed cuts are not now just in urban areas. You're for teaching in Shelbyville. They're cutting down there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You've got little rural schools out in the middle of nowhere who are trying to figure out how to keep their doors open. And some of these schools, if they close, it means students will be riding the buses for, you know, as much as an hour or so to get to another school system if they board up their doors.
All right. Teresa Barrett, if people want more information about what the Indiana State Teachers Association is all about, how do they get a hold of you? How to learn about y'all?
They can give us a call at 1-800-382-4037 or visit our website at www.ista-in.org or follow us on Facebook or Twitter.
All right. Teresa Barrett. Yeah, because I heard teachers all over. They all over Twitter. They're all over Facebook.
They're tweeting.
Tony Bennett learned that the hard way. Thanks, Teresa Barrett. Thanks very much for being
Thank
with
you,
us.
Amos.